The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Good afternoon, everyone. We'll begin the meeting. My name is Andrew Strain, and I will be serving as today's hearings officer for the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency hearings officer, a virtual meeting of July 8, 2021. Item one is our call to order. Item two is the approval of our agenda. I will ask the staff if there are any changes to our agenda as published. All right, hearing none, we'll proceed with the agenda as it's been published. Item three on today's agenda are the public interest comments for no action. Any member of the public wishing to address the hearings officer on any agenda item not listed as an announcement of appeal rights or as a public hearing item or on any other issue may do so at this time. However, public comments on announcement of appeal rights or public hearing items will be taken at the time that those agenda items are heard. Please note that the hearings officer is prohibited by law from taking immediate action on or discussing issues raised by the public that are not listed on this agenda. And with that, Georgina, are you running the controls today?
I am.
Terrific. Will you please look for a show of hands of anyone who would like to address the hearings officer as described?
Members of the public who would like to address the hearings officer may do so at this time by utilizing the hand-raising feature of the GoToWebinar app. The hand icon is located on the tab to the left of the GoToWebinar control panel. If you'd like to comment, please raise your hand and I will announce and unmute you, and you'll have 3 minutes to make your comments. Okay, no hands were raised, so we can continue with the review of this agenda item.
Thank you, Georgina. We'll move on to item number four, which is the announcement of appeal rights. I want to let those listening know that any decision of the hearings officer is appealable to the TRPA Governing Board within 21 days of the hearings officer decision. The application fee amount and appeal application can be found at the TRPA website. We'll move on to agenda item number five, public hearing items. Item 5A is the Mountain Meadow Retreat LLC Land Capability Challenge, located at 1091 Johnson Boulevard, City of South Lake Tahoe, California. The assessor's parcel number is 027-241-031, and the TRPA file number is LCAP 2021-0062. Julie Roll, I believe this is your agenda item. If you would please.
Hi, Andrew. Yes, Julie Roll here. So not a lot to say on this one. I haven't received any public comments. There are no changes to the staff summary that was posted. The project was reviewed for TRPA by our soils consultant, Marcel Munnicki, and Phil Scholes was hired as a private soils consultant by the applicant, and I believe he's on the line to answer any questions.
That's correct.
And as I understand it, we are being asked to consider changing the existing land capability classes of 1B, 3/4, and 7 to entirely class 6 for the entire parcel or project area. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And as I read through our staff report, and I believe also in Phil's technical report that was submitted, we have determined, or Phil has suggested, that we have an unnamed soil type in this area. Phil, can you give us a little background on what you found, please?
Yes. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Okay. I'm calling in, so I don't have the monitor stuff to look at. The findings are such that the property slopes from west to east Just beyond the property is the Bijou Golf Course, and part of that golf course includes Bijou Creek. And that's a well-known area of having SEZ. And the soil mapping shows that the west part was a high value or high high capability land, and the east part was low capability. An LCV was done later on that revised it to say a little bit of it was SEZ, a middle part of it was class three, and that the west part was class six. So the field study confirmed that the west part had class six, although it was a little bit different kind of soil. It didn't sort of meet all the requirements of the Elmira soil type. And then as we went towards the east, it drops a little bit in elevation, and we can see in the soil that the water table is getting closer, but ultimately the water table doesn't get within 40 inches of the surface, which means that when we look at the soil, we can see that the typical iron staining, or what we call redox features, pretty much begins below 40 inches. You can have a little bit of that redox above 40 inches, but it needs to get to sort of a significant concentration above 40 in order to count it as potential SEZ. And in this case, we weren't seeing that in the soil samples. So it sort of fit, the soil didn't fit in the category of a class six soil as Elmira, because Elmira doesn't allow a water table within 60 inches of the surface. But but under triple X or an unnamed soil, you can have essentially a soil that has a water table between 40 and 60 and still pencils out as class six. It's what we call a moderately well-drained soil. And there are a few other places in the basin where there's a moderately well-drained soil, but not many. And those typically come out as either class five or class six, depending on how rocky they are, things like that.
Thank you, Phil. And did any of the antecedent conditions affect your determinations in terms of where the groundwater table has been? I know we've had some dry years leading into this.
The field study was done last November, and that was at, you might say, the driest time of the year. So we didn't have a water table to observe see if it would be different than where the soil redox features are. The soil redox features tell us, that's the sort of the iron staining that we see in some of the pictures. Those show up because that reflects a long-term trend in the soil. And so a dry year wouldn't change the soil at all. And those redox features will stay there for decades. And so they take a long time to form, and they stick around for a long time. There has been some urban development in that area, but on the other hand, there's also been inputs of water into the Bijou watershed, so that, you know, the potential effect of urban development drawing up certain areas may be offset by them wetting up some of the lower areas. So we didn't necessarily see something that suggested that this is getting wetter or drier. I think the original perception that there was SEZ out there was based primarily on the presence of lodgepole pine, which when we see lodgepole pine in an SEZ, it's typically under the secondary indicators, but you also have to have subdominant species or shrub species and stuff that also are sort of wetter adapted. And we just didn't have those either on site, or there's some vacant land both to the north of it and one, and hopscotch over one lot to the south, and you still don't see SEZ understory type of vegetation there.
Interesting. Thank you, Phil. I know, and you made it in your comments too, that in the South Shore, the Bijou Meadow, part of it, which includes the golf course, but part of it's also native or more natural, and part of it has water quality treatment facility, and it is well recognized as a wet meadow and a stream zone, and this parcel in particular, I believe, adjoins it, is directly adjacent to the meadow. I was surprised to see that there was no SEZ found on this site.
I think when you stand on this, the particular property that is sort of challenged, some of the vegetation has been cleared and they put in lawn. And so it's not so obvious, but when you stand on the property or look on the property immediately to the north of it, which is a little bit lower, that you can clearly see that it's not an SEZ type of vegetation. So it's one of those situations where I think probably years of having cleared out vegetation and using sort of golf course kind of stuff, it may have allowed the lodgepole pine to be a little more dominant species than if it had just sort of been left natural.
Thank you.
That is a different way of looking at it. Lodgepole pine is a little bit of an opportunist species. So if it's sort of not wet enough for an SEZ, it likes that opportunity to sort of take advantage of, whereas something like Jeffrey pine, which is more drought tolerant, probably wouldn't try to invade that space very quickly.
Yes, I agree. Lodgepole seems to do better with its feet wet, so to speak.
Yeah.
I don't have any further questions. I'll open it up at this point. Do we have anyone representing the applicant on the line? Other than Phil. I'm usually used to speaking to you as our consultant.
Yeah, I spoke with the applicant planning consultant a few minutes ago, and she didn't feel like there was anything to add to the record, so she's not participating.
Thank you. At this point, I'll open up the public hearing on this item 5A and ask Georgina to look for a show of hands for anyone who would like to provide comment or input.
Members of the public who would like to address the hearings officer may do so at this time by utilizing the hand-raising feature of the GoToWebinar app. The hand icon is located on the tab to the left of the GoToWebinar control panel. If you'd like to comment, please raise your hand and I will announce and unmute you, and you'll have 3 minutes to make your comments. And no hands were raised, so we can continue with the agenda.
Thank you, Georgina. Seeing that we have no public comment this afternoon, I will close the public hearing and I'll take action on the project. Based on the required findings and conclusions that are contained in our staff report, the information that's provided in support of that, I will approve the land capability challenge as it has been proposed. Let's move on then to item 5B, University of Nevada, Reno, water quality monitoring stations, various locations within Lake Tahoe. TRPA file is EIPS 2021-0009, and the project number is 570-000-00. Paul Nielsen, I understand this is your item. Can you please give us an introduction?
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. I was going to defer to Dan Segan on this one, TRP staff, who's got a little bit more background.
That's fine. Dan, the floor
is yours. Good afternoon, Andrew and other members. This is Dan Segan from TRPA's research and analysis team. And before turning it over to the applicant itself, I just wanted to say that I am part of the Tahoe Region Nearshore Agency Working Group, which regularly meets to coordinate agency investments in understanding the nearshore. And as a group of agencies, we were very excited to see this project come across our desks, because better understanding the linkages between our watersheds and how those influence in-lake processes and specifically algal growth within our nearshore is a priority that we have invested in numerous times over the last 5 years. And we believe this project supports that aim and look forward to the findings of the project. And with that, I'll turn it back over to you, Andrew, or to Paul and the applicants.
Good, and we have one or more of the applicants here this afternoon. I thought I'd heard Dr. Sudeep say hello at the beginning as we were getting ready to start the meeting. Welcome, Doctor, and can you please give us a brief background on this project and your proposal?
Sure. This is Dr. Sudeep Chandra from the University of Nevada, Reno. If it's okay, I would like to defer to my colleague who is online, who has more details about the project, and I'll fill in gaps in just a moment if needed.
Hello. My name is Dr. Joanna Blaschuk. I'm also a professor here at the University of Nevada, Reno. And thank you for having us today to describe our project. So just as Dan described, we're really interested in understanding the linkages between nearshore algal growth in Lake Tahoe that impacts water clarity and watershed and stream dynamics. So that includes monitoring the dissolved oxygen and temperature in the water column using environmental sensors. And so what we're requesting is that we would like to put out a sensor array. So that means a couple of different locations where we would attach sensors to both cinder blocks as well as to subsurface buoys, where the sensors are suspended in the water column but near the bottom. And these would be located currently at the outlet of both Glenbrook Creek on the east shore and Blackwood Creek on the west shore. And what this would allow us to do is use the data that we get from these sensors to better understand the timing of algal growth and how it's related to nitrogen delivery to the near shore, as well as the different factors that control the timing of algal growth and the amount of algal growth. Sudeep, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Yes, but if I might just add that if it's helpful for others to know, there are other lake environments in Northern California that are adopting similar approaches. And we've placed sensors here in Northern California near Mount Shasta, but also have worked with the National Park Service in a similar setup, placed them at Crater Lake in Oregon. And to our knowledge, there have been no issues the last 5 years of placement of these types of sensors and the structures that are in the water. So just giving you a background from other systems as well, where there have not been any problems reported to either our agencies or our scientists working there. Thanks.
Any other comments from either of the doctors? This afternoon is deferral after the afternoon meeting.
Andrew, this is Paul. Just want to mention no changes to the staff summary or permit are proposed at this time.
Thank you, Paul. And doctors, how did you select these particular locations for this first set of arrays?
I could take that question, Joanna, if that's okay. There are probably two or three different reasons why we've selected them. One is from a scientific viewpoint and trying to understand changes in the nearshore algal ecology of the lakes. We know that there are different climate patterns on the west shore versus the east shore. And so since climate change is an increasingly common driver of changes of water quality, we wanted to make sure scientifically we set up sensors in sides of the lake that have a little more precipitation or maybe a little less precipitation coming from the watershed. Another reason to set up these sensors in these particular locations is that the west shore has the longest term monitoring by UC Davis of algal chlorophyll dynamics, and it has also been a research focus with USGS and University of Nevada along the west shore. And so we wanted to make sure some of these studies are anchored with some longer term histories of data collection so we can interpret our data a little better. And then lastly, the third component is the community, at least on the east shore at Glenbrook, has been quite positive about welcoming in science into their community. And so part of what we're also developing with the sensors and the research that's being conducted is we'd like to share that information with the community of Glenbrook. And so that was another reason for site selection with the Glenbrook community. Joanna, does that summarize it?
Yes, that sounds great. Thank you, CD.
And Sudeep, to follow up, are we concerned at all or interested in trying to gather this type of data from our largest tributary that's on the South Shore, the Upper Truckee River?
Yeah, that's a great question. We are concerned about that. And our longer-term vision is to first take a pilot step forward, have these sensors placed in two locations more immediately. But the vision is to also put these sensors, if information is appropriate, into the Upper Truckee inflow areas because it has the largest amount of nutrients and sediments coming into the lake as a whole, as a bulk. So you are correct. The nearshore as a whole is quite dynamic in terms of its algal growth, meaning dynamic in the sense of time, but also in space. It's some locations that we see algal growth and some locations we don't see growth. And trying to understand that right now is sort of a novel step for us at Lake Tahoe. So that long-term vision of having things from the Upper Truckee region down, the east shore, the west shore, and perhaps from the watersheds that have more disturbance or less disturbance will be important to understanding this emerging issue.
And you, do you have the rest of your, I see that we're taking action on 12, I believe it is, specific placements today, and a total of 30 will be approved pending some, review subsequently. Do you have a priority list in your mind or on paper of where you'll go next?
Not necessarily priority list, but definitely the major tributaries that have the long-term ecological loading information from the USGS. But I would actually defer to Joanna for just a moment to think if she has a priority list after evaluating some of the USGS data.
I agree with you, Sudeep, that we would first target locations where we have the USGS gauging stations on the incoming tributaries. And then following that, just as Sudeep said, I think we would want to be selecting sites along climate gradients or disturbance gradients. And when I mean disturbance, I mean sort of development and the catchment to better understand how those factors influence algal growth, because just as Sudeep was saying, it's very dynamic both in time and in space around the lake.
Thank you. There one sentence in your write-up that was carried forward into the staff report that caught my eye had to do with the algal growth, the relationship, the nearshore water quality, including algal growth, is intimately tied to the internal dynamics within the lake. For example, mixing and grazing by animals and the supply of nutrients from the streams and groundwater entering the lake. And we've been talking so far, I think, about mostly the nutrients that are inbound, so to speak, from the surrounding watersheds. What is it that you've got in mind to try and learn about grazing? I wasn't aware that we still had a lot of active grazing.
Andrew, this is Sudeep. I can take that lead on for on behalf of my colleague and myself. So this is an exciting part of science, guys, up at the lake, where the grazing that we're thinking about isn't by the animal grazing in the watershed that was historically present. It's by the critters within the lake. And it turns out the crayfish in the lake that were introduced four times since the 1800s have firmly established in the lake, as many of us know. And the crayfish that's the size of your hand is about 10 years old. So it turns out these crayfish that are invasive and about 10 years old also act as grazers on algae or on invertebrates like snails that might eat the algae. And so we currently have projects on the west shore funded through the Lahontan Water Quality Control Board of California to look at the influence of crayfish grazers on the algal community, and the resulting water quality is what we'd like to measure with oxygen and temperature. So there are these, as noted in the report, there are these effects not only from the delivery of nutrients from the watershed and the connections from watershed to lake, but internally what the role of these invasive biological organisms might be to grazing the invertebrates that might eat the algae or excreting nutrients that these crayfish might excrete, like ammonium, to actually stimulate algal growth. And as just one brief aside, since this is a public comment or public period where people might be listening, another exciting outcome not found at Lake Tahoe, but through our colleagues up at Crater Lake, which is similar to Lake Tahoe up in Oregon, is that the crayfish are contributing to the nearshore algal growth through the mechanisms I just described, either through grazing the invertebrates or pooping out nutrients, basically, that might stimulate algal growth. And so we want to see to what extent that might be happening at Lake Tahoe, and these sensors will help get at some of that, those answers.
Thank you. That is interesting. And you did mention, again, one of the other lakes that a similar type of investigation has already been occurring. You mentioned, I think, I don't know if it was Shasta Lake or a lake near Mount Shasta, as well as Crater Lake. And the quality of the data that's come from those, has that been valuable to you or your colleagues in trying to better understand these relationships?
Yes, thanks for asking that question. It really has been highly valuable. So I'll just mention the work up at Crater Lake, for example, has helped the National Park Service understand what the drivers of water quality in the near shore might be and whether or not they need or are able to manage crayfish populations as they expand around the lake. The work up in Mount Shasta at a much smaller lake, actually I'm stationed here right now at Castle Lake, it's allowing the sensors are allowing us to understand near real-time daily dynamics in growth of the algae, because the sensors measure oxygen, and oxygen's a byproduct of algal growth through photosynthesis. So the long story short is that both of these lakes, we've actually incorporated these sensors into the long-term monitoring program to help interpret and understand the relationship of water quality changes from the watershed, or from crayfish grazing, or more recently, the effects of wildfire smoke in shading the water and then causing increased algal growth. So these sensors can play a lot of tools, provide a lot of information with just a simple tool.
Thank you, Sudeep. And I note that at least on the Glenbrook site, perhaps to a lesser degree on the Blackwood Canyon site, we've got existing boating activity and buoys and or piers in the neighborhood that aren't far from these. And if I'm understanding your proposal, it would involve some sensors and other devices with some anchoring devices that end up suspended in the water column in relatively shallow waters. I presume that some safety investigation or safety review by at least the Coast Guard is going to happen as a part of this, so that we don't have the unintended consequences of creating an additional boating or safety hazard. Is that your understanding?
Yes, this is Joanna again. That is correct. Right now I'm coordinating with the Coast Guard as well as the Army Corps and several other agencies to make sure that we're not creating a navigational hazard. And so right now we've both reached out to those agencies, and we're reaching out to the HOAs to make sure that everyone's on board with at what depth the subsurface float could be, such that everything is safe and we're not posing any hazard.
Any feedback on that so far from any of the entities you mentioned?
Well, yesterday I was actually on the phone with the Army Corps, and she directed me to get in touch with the Coast Guard, and I haven't heard back from them yet. I emailed them yesterday. And then Sudeep is, as far as I understand, reaching out to the HOA in Glenbrook, and we are identifying the appropriate HOA for the Blackwood site currently.
Good. When do you ideally plan to install these?
We're going through this permitting process again with several different agencies right now. And so ideally it would be, I would say by the end of August, but that all depends on us receiving all of the appropriate permissions for the sites.
So sometime later this summer?
If we can, yes.
And how exactly, go ahead, Sudeep.
Andrew, ideally in the dream world of having a unique climate situation that's occurring at Lake Tahoe this year with all the water level receding and the drought. Ideally, we would put them in ASAP, but we do recognize that we need to work through approvals from as many different of our colleagues and counterparts. And so that's why we'd like to aim for the end of summer so we don't lose some of the opportunity for this year for getting an insights as to what drought can do to the lake.
That's certainly understandable, and we appreciate you working along as part of the team because everybody is trying to pull on the oar in the same direction. And exactly how did these get installed? Looking at the photographs and some of the other information in our staff report, and I'm curious how you'll physically get them in position.
So we are in touch with divers that can be hired to install them for the initial installment. And for both scientific purposes of having the sensor suspended in the water column so we're sure we're sampling a well-mixed area, but also for retrieving the sensors, when we go out and we regularly download the data and clean off the sensors and just check in on them, we will be retrieving them from a boat and then lowering them back down to the same position. But for the cinder blocks, those we will be hiring divers, or some of our students here have dive certification.
I see. Yes, it looks like a unique opportunity to get these installed. And you made a great point too there, Joanna, to maintain them so that they remain effective and to download the data that you need from them. I do have one request before I open the public hearing, then I'll open the public hearing with Dan Siegen from our team. Off the agency staff is our nearshore specialist and staff person. Would it be possible for him to accompany you and or your teams on one of these outings so he can have a better understanding and see it for himself, how these are either installed or serviced? Is that possible to have him attend one of these outings that you do in support of this?
Absolutely, that would be great. Yep.
I think it would be extremely valuable to bring that experience and understanding back to the agency as part of our resources, and I appreciate that. Thank you, Joanna. I'd like to open up the public hearing at this time and ask if anyone who's in our audience today has any comments or testimony they'd like to provide. Georgina, can you please look for a show of hands?
Members of the public who would like to address the hearings officer may do so at this time by utilizing the hand-raising feature of the GoToWebinar app. The hand icon is located on the tab to the left of the GoToWebinar control panel. If you'd like to comment, please raise your hand and I will announce and unmute you, and you'll have 3 minutes to make your comments. And no hands were raised, so we can continue with the review of this agenda item.
Thank you, Georgina. I'll close the public hearing at this point and take action on the project. Based on the staff's recommendation, the information that's been presented in support of the environmental checklist and the FONSI, the finding of no significant effect, the terms and conditions that are proposed in the draft permit, as well as the required findings that need to be made as part of our process listed in the staff report, and that includes our Chapter 4 findings, several, I believe, sections from Chapter 80 related to lake zone and special use in the lake zone. I think there's one more in here too in the 80s for our additional findings. Yep, I hit that for the special uses. I will approve the project as it's proposed and wish you absolute great success in bringing back some more good data for us to figure out these relationships that we're interested in.
Excellent. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
And thank you for the informative presentation and questions and answers. This is quite helpful.
Thanks, Andrew.
And with that, that concludes agenda item 5, our public hearing items. We'll move on to agenda item number 6, adjournment. I want to thank everyone participating today for their time and interest, and we'll stand adjourned. Thank you.
Ending the meeting in 3, 2, 1.